We are talking once again with Jav Parrish, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right. A week to be remembered.
That's a polite way of putting it.
Yeah. They're just getting better and better as time goes on. But we'll be... we'll be getting to that in a bit. Springtime for Putin. Oh, okay. Turns out, we just heard, like, I think in the last day that apparently President Joe Biden will be coming to town next week.
Yeah, he's doing a swing through the Northwest, first Portland, then Seattle. He'll be here on Friday, according to the White House schedule, but they're not releasing any details yet. So look for that, and look for the inevitable protest as well.
And counter protests and
blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
Apparently he's coming to kiss some babies.
Yep. I was hoping he's coming here for Earth Day.
And okay.
I was hoping he'd be here a couple of days earlier so we could celebrate 420, but, you know, there'll be plenty of other people to do that for him, so.
Well, inevitably somehow it'll get turned into numerous fundraising pitches for the Democratic Party.
So. Very likely, yes. And I'm sure there will be a high-end dinner because that's why presidents come to Seattle, is to, you know, meet with very wealthy donors. You know, it's kind of bizarre having a president come to town since, certainly Obama was here frequently and then Trump never showed up at all because he only went to states with adoring crowds.
And well, we're an anarchist jurisdiction.
So. That's true. I'd forgotten about that. Good Lord.
They had to redo all the maps. So
just yeah, I know. I know. Yeah, then this thick border around Seattle, you know, don't go here.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
Okay, moving on. Report this week, and I'm blanking on who wrote it, about the Seattle Police Department opening a mini precinct downtown.
Yeah, and there's actually proposals for a couple of them. These are the little storefront operations that you see in different parts of the city. And it's surprising that there isn't one downtown. I guess it's probably because, you know, storefronts are more valuable as storefronts. But Lehigh, the Low Income Housing Institute, which operates a number of homeless encampments around the city that they basically stole from Nicholsville a few years ago, is also offering to SPD use of a couple of its different buildings downtown as locations for neighborhood centers. These are, that's the euphemism for a, you know, a cop shop, basically. So one is on 3rd Avenue downtown, which is going to probably get the priority since there's been such a backlash over the state of 3rd Avenue. Particularly with homeless encampments and the like. And they're also considering a second location at the Fry Apartments in Pioneer Square. So that's coming from both Mayor Harrell's office and longtime Lehigh Director Sharon Lee. And, you know, it kind of begs the question of are these enabling neighborhood sweeps? Are they, you know, are they doing more harm than good so far as the homeless situation is concerned? And isn't Lehigh's mission to serve the underprivileged, including, you know, trying to provide housing for the homeless? So I have mixed emotions about that. I think you would find a lot of people in the homeless community speaking off the record, saying that Lehigh is not a particularly helpful presence in the effort to provide permanent housing for homelessness, but that kind of surprised me that they were willing to go there. But Sharon Lee is very close to Bruce Harrell, And, you know, they are all about making each other look good. So, this will probably happen, I think.
I had blanked on it. It was, from Erica Barnett's reporting at Publicola. So she
gets
credit for all that. It's interesting. I know in the university district that they have, I believe they still have a cop shop there that, doesn't look, when I walk by, it doesn't look like it has any people in it, anymore, but.
Yeah, I've noticed that too.
But it does beg the question of how many of these are still in existence across the city, and I don't really believe that had any significant impact on what was transpiring out on, you know, the streets in the U District.
And the cop shop that was there replaced a bunch of peace groups, nonprofits. So yeah, the irony is thick. I have not seen anybody in there for years. So, and they have one in Ballard, and there's other ones around town. So,
it'd be interesting if there was a map of all those.
Sure, there is somewhere.
Yeah. All right. Well, continuing with reporting from Erica C. Barnett this week at Publicola, there was a review that came out this week from the Monitor, the Oversight Monitor.
Yeah, James Robard. And, that report was a review of SPD's use of force over the last 3 years. Now, it turns out that SPD has not been keeping very good records of use of force, particularly during the summer months of 2020, which, as we know, you know, had a lot of use of force. It was analysis of, whether, race seemed to be a factor in use of force within SPD. And predictably, even despite the data not being very good, it was. Despite the overall decline in use of force, except during the 2020 months that I mentioned, SPD were far more likely to use force against Black and Native people than against white suspects, and that Blacks were most likely to experience the most serious form of force, which includes shootings by police. 36% of use of force incidents involve Black individuals, who make up just over 7% of Seattle's population. So it's way disproportionate. Now, that doesn't tell you what the ratio of arrests, whether that's also very high for Blacks versus white. And again, you know, I've seen past statistics where it's also much higher. And, you know, the designation of neighborhood hotspots by SPD almost always seems to involve places on the south side that are majority non-white. Remarkably, SPD failed to record the race of people it beat up or shot or whatever, in nearly a third of the cases during the summer 2020 months, but also a significant number the rest of the year as well. So we don't actually know, because the sample size is skewed. You know, if it turns out that it wasn't recorded in most of the cases where there were non-white suspects, then that would change the numbers a lot. So, once again, SPD avoids accountability through bad record keeping. We've seen this before. And again, this is coming out of, Judge Robard's, office. It's been, 10 years now we've had this consent decree, and the SPD is still not in compliance with the Federal Monitor. And apparently there are negotiations going on with SPOG now, which it last had a contract in 2017, but we're not hearing a whole lot out of that process. In theory, community groups have a seat at that table. But, you know, whether that's actually being practiced or not is a good question.
That table being the Community Police Commission.
Yes, exactly. And people are, have been complaining of late about the CPC's accountability as well. You know, layers upon layers of non-accountability.
Well, and not just the CPC. You have to include pretty much all the oversight bodies, the four different oversight bodies that the city has, the OIG, CPC, the OPA, and the Public Safety Committee.
Yes.
At Seattle City Council.
And then, can we get some more acronyms in there? because I don't think the public is confused enough.
Well, the Office of Inspector General would be the OIG.
Right. The Office of Police Accountability
would be one, yeah. And then the again, the Department of Justice monitor, who spoke this week and who they had a public engagement meeting on Tuesday while he talked about, well, the representative for them talked about this specific issue and pretty much tried to put a nice gloss on this report that the public who were participating in that weren't having.
All of that.
So it was pretty heated. I definitely recommend people check that out if you want to get a better sense of the oversight process that currently is taking place in Seattle. Oversight in quotes. And in fact, at Tuesday's meeting, and the Seattle Human Rights Commission apparently is now getting involved with this issue.
That oh, dear Lord.
They think it's so bad that they were present at the meeting just as attendees, not as officially speaking on the city's behalf. But they're looking at – they've hired an attorney to look into challenging the amicus, the legal standing that the court, the DOJ, and the city will be using. I'm not wording this well at all. But anyway, they're getting heavily involved, and they've been having a lot of people who have been approaching them because they felt that the Community Police Commission has not been very supportive of specific people who have been coming towards them to try and get relief. So, which includes family members of people who have been shot and killed by SPD.
Right.
So that is pretty significant. And for instance, I know Carolyn Bick has wrote about that recently, and it appears to be.
Yeah. And I would say Carolyn Bick and Erica C. Barnett are, probably more effective accountability mechanisms for SPD than any of these organizations.
Well, I've said that before.
So go follow them.
Carolyn Bick is doing the best work right now on this.
No, Carolyn is a treasurer. So yes. Go follow her at the South Seattle Emerald.
Moving on, I saw this week that UFCW is ramping up for informational pickets. Starting this week?
No, it's actually starting a week from Monday, the 26th. And they'll be having informational pickets at most area grocery stores, all the majors. So, you know, the checker and stocking positions at all these grocery stores are unionized. And, you know, there's a lot of complaints coming from workers about shift scheduling and, you know, the healthcare and all the usual stuff. There were actually quite a few labor items in the business section of the paper this week. So Verizon workers in Snohomish County voted 11-1 for their couple of different stores in Snohomish to unionize. And again, they have very similar complaints. Verizon has been slowly unionizing. Three of their stores in New York City recently voted to unionize. So these stores in Washington State will in theory join them. And then there was a Starbucks 3-day work stoppage downtown by, you know, baristas and others trying to pressure management to address some of their concerns. And, of course, Starbucks, a store on Capitol Hill, recently unionized. So they're moving in that direction as well. And there was another one-day stoppage yesterday for a store in Eastlake. So this is a somewhat contagious movement. You know, we haven't seen this much labor organizing, speaking broadly around the country, in a long time. And a lot of that, of course, is because of the pandemic, because people were left in a world of hurt, and because unemployment is very low, so workers have more leverage. So we'll see what develops. I think in particular the Starbucks movement is worth keeping an eye on. And Amazon, of course.
And it was interesting to me to see that local public radio stations, KNKX and KOW, just had their fund drives, pledge drives, over the last couple of weeks. And none of them noted that I could see that simultaneously their reporters and workers were in negotiations for their contracts during that time. I guess that just doesn't work into the pitches, you know, when you're
not really,
you should support our station.
Get this coffee mug made in China.
So it's just kind of surreal, the disconnect. Yeah. And as you had started that segment talking about, you know, in the business section again, and we pointed this out before, that once upon a time, papers and perhaps some other medium, probably just newspapers, used to have labor sections.
Right. It got subsumed into a long list of how your stocks did today.
Meanwhile, you know, across the country, giant hedge funds are snapping up, you know, newspaper chains, and we all know what happens when that takes place. Then they, of course, consolidate and get rid of staff at different entities, and, you know, before you know it, we're all listening to Alexa reading us the news.
Pretty much, yep.
All right. Well, speaking of newspapers, there appears to be a kerfluffle in Spokane Valley.
To use the technical term, yes. Spokane Valley is a fairly populous suburb of Spokane. Spokane's about 200,000 people. Spokane Valley to the east is about 70,000, last I looked. It tends to be very conservative. That's where Matt Shea came from, the notorious, basically neo-Nazi, former member of the state legislature. And now there is a proposal before the Spokane Valley City Council to ban quote-unquote third-party publications, which is basically all the freebies. You know, the equivalent of what used to be the Stranger here is the Inlander over there. And there's some other newspapers as well. So they want to ban them from all city property. And the reason this kind of piqued my interest is the rationale that's being used. The free papers often include political advertisements during their run-up to local elections. And state law prohibits campaign materials on government property, so those ads can't be displayed on City Hall. Well, yes and no. I mean, that's certainly never been enforced. But, you know, the theory over there is that the Inlander is being particularly singled out because they apparently have a dogged reporter. The Spokane equivalent of Carolyn Bick. And so this is a way of censoring them, basically. It's a weird rationale, you know, because the campaigns aren't actually producing the newspaper. They're just producing the artwork that goes into the ads, and then paying for the ads. But, yeah, it's a strange rationale, put it that way. Because, you know, are you going to, ban any political coverage? And because that would be the next logical step. It's a, you know, it's certainly a way of avoiding accountability in the run up to an election.
Well, I think the bigger issue, that isn't being addressed is the fact that actually one of the city council members, runs one of the newspapers. So he and his wife actually produce one of the newspapers. And with the recent elections, you basically have a 3-3 split between council members who are right and left of each other. And, and having one of the council members producing one of the newspapers, is really what's setting off the other three. So, I think that has probably more to do with it than anything.
Yeah, probably.
And the fact that, you know, they're not talking about any of the primary papers, like the spokesman for.
Yeah, the Spokesman Review.
Right. You know, which also carries, you know, paid content during elections. So, so I suspect that that's actually fueling this more than anything, but.
Yeah, but I foresee lawsuits if they go through this.
That's entirely reasonable.
Because that's what we do in America. We sue each other.
That's one of the few things we appear to be good at.
Yep.
All right. So.
Speaking of lawsuits in Eastern Washington. We had a significant ruling in the Supreme Court of Idaho, right across the border this week. Planned Parenthood, which operates in Idaho as well as the regional authority, is based in Seattle, but it covers several different Northwest states. They sued the state of Idaho over its recent, which we talked about, the ban on abortions that the state legislature passed and the governor signed that outlaws abortions after 6 weeks, which of course is, you know, sooner than many women even know they're pregnant, and also sets up a similar, it's based on the Texas law, sets up a similar vigilante system where family members can sue if they believe that a woman has had an abortion, and, you know, collect a bounty basically for turning her in. So Planned Parenthood sued over this, and this week the Idaho Supreme Court issued a stay on that law while they looked at the legal, issues that the Planned Parenthood raised. So, at least it is not in effect. That doesn't mean that the law has been overturned, but it means that the, lawsuit can go forward. So that's a, that was a brief bit of good news.
All right. And also this week, developments with Washington redistricting?
Yes. Washington's redistricting plan will go into effect. We're on our legal section now, I guess. You remember we've talked in past weeks that a couple different Latino advocacy groups in Central Washington had sued over the redistricting plan because it split the redistricting split Central Washington in terms of the federal congressional seats so that basically it protects the Republicans in power and prevents any non-white candidate from getting any traction. Court ruled this week that the redistricting will take effect for 2022 for the midterms coming up in November, in only 7 months. So that despite those lawsuits still being active. So it's still possible that the boundaries will change depending on the outcome of the lawsuits. But for the 2022 election, because the state secretary of health needs to start printing the ballots in, I believe, early June. So they had to go forward with that, so they'll go forward with the current plan.
That then takes us on to this week's developments with the pandemic.
Yeah, and guess what? King County is a hot spot. We had gotten down about a month ago to about 150 new cases a day. We're now well over 500 new cases a day. So the BA2 subvariant of Omicron is by far the dominant variant or subvariant at this point. And, you know, it's not going to get any better. Apparently, there have been two new subvariants of Omicron identified in New York State that are now accounting for majority of the cases there. And if you look at the CDC's maps, the entire Northeast seaboard is solid red. All of those states, all the way through New England, New York, Mid-Atlantic, have extremely high rates of community spread. And that's inevitably going to find its way back here as well. So I think it's going to get worse before it gets better. So, again, if you're in an indoor space with poor ventilation, wear a mask, please. Protect yourself, regardless of your vaccination status. Last week I got my second booster, and I survived it, which is good. So that's widely available now, too. So you can, you know, schedule it at your health care provider or your pharmacy or wherever you go. There's plenty of vaccine available. But
is the county or state or anyone responding to the increase in cases?
No, not really. The city of Philadelphia this week became the only U.S. city to reinstitute a mask mandate indoors. And Seattle has half the population of Philadelphia, right? And it's already got more cases per day than Philadelphia does. But nobody's talking about doing anything. Certainly they're not at the state level or the county level either. And there's been almost no local media coverage. It's like people just sort of unilaterally decided that the pandemic was over and forgot to notify the virus. So, you know, and I hate to say I told you so, but we did say at the time they were lifting the mask mandate about a month ago that it was way too early and that it was going to make a comeback. And here we are. You know, their new case rates have tripled in the last month. Locally.
Do you have a sense, numbers-wise, of the current number of cases versus what the numbers were when they instituted mask mandates? Are we at that level yet, or?
I think we're well beyond it. I mean, I would have to go back and you're talking like in 2020, right? Because the relative number of cases in 2020 has actually been dwarfed several times over by first the Delta, now the Omicron variants. Now the severity of the cases is not as bad. But you've also got about a third of positive COVID patients winding up with some form of long COVID. And we don't even know what causes that or, you know, how long it lasts, what the longer term impacts of those are. It's still a serious public health issue. And, we've learned how to treat the virus better over the past couple of years. And of course, there is a vaccine available that will help you prevent you from getting it or prevent you from getting more severe cases of it. So, it's well worth getting the vaccine if you can. It's available in most areas and very few people actually have the kind of health concerns that would prevent you from getting a vaccine. I know this because my partner is one of them, but, it's totally preventable at this point. You can get breakthrough cases, but those breakthrough cases tend to be milder. And, you know, the hospitalization rates and death rates are not as bad as they were early in the pandemic because we learned how to treat it better, as well as the vaccine being available. But yeah, we shut down the entire economy, you know, over a relatively small number of cases compared to what we've had since. I would say also we're going to hit a pretty significant milestone in the next week or two of 1 million deaths in the U.S. from the pandemic, which is just, you know, hard to wrap your head around that. But just, you know, gravestones as far as you can see, basically.
Yeah, and meanwhile, the hospitals haven't bounced back with, I mean, not that they were particularly robust prior to this, because they certainly weren't. But, you know, you still have people that are completely working at the hospitals that are completely burnt out. A lot of people who have left working in the medical field because of that. And no support nationally for looking at single-payer healthcare or universal healthcare.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that the pandemic has really highlighted is how dysfunctional U.S. healthcare is. And, you know, you would hope that at some point there would be a hard reckoning with how the U.S. handled or didn't handle the pandemic and looking at reforms that might take place at the federal level. It seems like people have just decided that they're tired of the pandemic. It's over. We don't want to think about it anymore. We don't want to talk about it anymore. And we're certainly not going to spend the time it would take to, and the political capital that it would take to fix some of the problems that were highlighted by how the U.S. handled the pandemic. I think the first and, you know, the evil from which all evils flowed was the Trump administration decision to devolve all authority to the states, because that has allowed Republican-led states to basically ignore the pandemic. And the death rates per capita in those states have almost uniformly been much higher than in states like Washington that at least tried to follow the science. I mean, we've certainly been critical of Inglesey's office for basically caving to the pressure from the business community in terms of making political decisions to lift pandemic restrictions. But compared to the free-for-all that's been happening in Republican-led states, we actually made out much better than most of the country. I think the Washington state, the per capita death rate is in the last five of the 50 states. So we did well. Oregon did well. And well, of course, is a relative term. Because, you know, the pandemic is still going to take its toll no matter what the political leadership does.
Yeah. Well, I did see this week that, some video of, what's happening in some spots in China, and that looked pretty dramatic.
China's in a world of hurt, particularly Shanghai, which is the metropolis of 26 million people. For reference, that's, you know, 3.5 times the population of Washington State. It's one of the largest cities in the world, and they have been in a lockdown for nearly a month now, where people literally haven't been able to go out to get groceries, medications. It's a, you know, there have been street protests against this, people banging pots and pans at night. It's taken a number of forms, but people are very unhappy and have every right to be. Meanwhile, the other two of China's big three cities are Guangdong in the south near Hong Kong. Used to be called Canton, and Beijing in the north. You're seeing panic buying in Beijing as people watch on TV what's happening in Shanghai. And then Guangdong just a couple days ago was closed off to all entry because they're getting ready to lock down that city because of its high case rate. Hong Kong is now part of China also, of course. They've had their wave as well. So, yeah, there's even one case. They're trying to stop community spread, but it's well beyond that in Shanghai. It's thousands of new cases a day. It's a crowded metropolis, and the virus has a foothold there the way it hasn't so far in any other Chinese city. So, what does that mean for us? Well, Guangdong in particular is a port city where a lot of the supply chain manufacturing flows through. It's almost certainly on Western economies. It's not good. The problem with trying to track the outbreaks in Chinese cities is the Chinese government estimates of particularly hospitalizations and deaths just are not reliable. They're badly undercounted, as, you know, local bureaucracies try to make themselves look good. So it's hard to say exactly how extensive the pandemic is, but it sounds pretty extensive. So,
all right.
On to national news.
Yes, developments with the January 6th investigation.
Yeah, that investigation continues. And we got new revelations this week through the select committee in the House on investigating January 6th. Testimony leaked from that committee that several Republican lawmakers in Congress were in on the advanced planning, particularly Senator Mike Lee in Utah and a Texas representative named Chip Roy. They were sending texts back and forth to then White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, you know, talking about how we have to try and stop the count of the electors, and we really need to actually have some evidence for this, when their, you know, public statements were exactly the opposite of that. The significance of this is that it shows that the rot in the Republican Party extended well past the White House, that Trump's allies in Congress were also trying to plot to overturn the election, which is, you know, basically a coup d'etat. And I think that one of the aspects that's not getting covered in media coverage of this is that this was just one piece of evidence that leaked from the January 6th committee, who has taken testimony from hundreds and hundreds of people within the Trump orbit over the past several months, including in the last couple of weeks from Ivanka Trump and her freeloading husband, who got a ton of money from the Saudis recently. I mean, the whole thing was just so corrupt. And, you know, how much evidence is the select committee sitting on? Well, we'll find out probably next month when they start holding public hearings. They're still taking testimony from people. They're still referring people to the Department of Justice for possible prosecution for refusing to comply with subpoenas. So far, the DOJ has only prosecuted one person, that being Steve Bannon. But there have been several additional referrals from close Trump aides who were in the inside of the planning for January 6th. And, you know, this all begs the question itself of what about Trump himself? Well, when you're prosecuting a crime family, a mob, and that certainly was the organizing principle of the Trump White House, you know, you start with the small guys, try and flip them, and you work your way up to the capo, which in this case was the former president. And hopefully, at some point this year, all this dirty laundry will be aired, and there will be some additional accountability for some of the planners of January 6th, up to and including Mr. Trump.
Okay, additional accountability. Has there been any accountability of the planners at this point?
Well, no, not really. court of public opinion, but you know, their cult doesn't really care at this point.
Yeah. So in May, they're anticipating having public hearings?
That was the last date I saw. It keeps getting pushed back as they, you know, add people that they want to get testimony from. But at some point, there will be a written report for public consumption, and there will be public hearings. And, you know, they'll probably push it right back up into the primary season for the midterms.
Yeah. Well, and they could, you know, begin public hearings and still be pursuing stuff behind the scenes as, you know.
Of course.
Evidence comes forward. I mean, this could last easily through the next, you know, future administrations, the way it's going. And the basis.
Yeah. Assuming we have more than one future administration, but that's another rant for another time.
All right, moving on. Texas Governor Abbott making the news this week.
Yeah, for all the wrong reasons. Initially, he had instituted at the state level inspections of all the trucks coming over from Mexico, which resulted in you know, traffic jams in places like Laredo and McAllen, backing up for miles and miles and miles, just a sea of trucks. Now, oddly enough, the Freedom Convoy didn't seem to be concerned about protesting that. He lifted that inspection program this week after a lot of bad PR, and I'm sure a lot of businesses in his state that support his political career objecting as well. So that has been lifted now, but it really underscores how a lot of Abbott's moves around that, around abortion, around, you know, you name it, all the different red meat issues for the Republican base. You know, he's really been engaging in a lot of kabuki, in a lot of stuff that you know, he deployed Texas National Guard to the border. That has been lifted now, I believe, as well, because they just weren't doing anything at the border. It was supposed to be, you know, catching a wave of illegal immigrants, but they weren't. So, you know, a lot of it's just for show. And Abbott is in the middle of a reelection campaign against he's running against oh God, I'm drawing a blank on his name. The guy from El Paso. Beto O'Rourke, that's it.
Oh, okay.
They have got the nominations because Texas already had its primaries last month. So they're running against each other for governor right now. And you know, so Abbott's looking for any political stunt that he can find to keep his name in the news. And, you know, appease his base. So answer me this. Why is it that Republicans have some degree of success by doubling down on their most rabid extremist voters, whereas the advice you always hear for Democrats is to move to the center? And that never seems to work. Why, for instance, do we not have a vibrant movement? I'm talking nationally. I'm not talking Seattle. That goes toward a more progressive direction, which actually isn't extremist. It aligns with the views of a majority of Americans on issue after issue. But the advice is always to move to the center. You need to be more centrist. You need to be more like Joe Manchin or Kristen Sinema. In other words, you know, you need to be more Republican. And it never seems to work. Whereas the Republican response to losing an election is to always become more radicalized. And they haven't paid a price for that yet. They should. They should be considered unfit to govern, but they're not.
Yeah, I don't know. It's possible. It's genetic. Within the Democratic Party,
the loss of a spine,
Yes, the softening of the spine that has been going on for generations there, and that basically turning what I don't know if they ever actually had a solid spine, but perhaps, you know, they're slowly morphing into jellyfish.
I'm sure there's a medical term for it.
Yeah. Oh, no doubt. Probably multiple medical terms for it.
Yes. Anyway, that's just a short digression. Also, speaking of radicalized Republicans, the Wisconsin Supreme Court, which is a partisan body that is majority Republican, upheld the Republican Party's partisan drawing of congressional districts in that state this week. Now, I don't know how bad the gerrymandering is expected to be this time around, but I know for the map that was drawn for the last 10 years, it's something like, you know, a majority of Wisconsinites, is that how it's best said? I think so. A majority of Wisconsinians voted for Democrats, and yet three-quarters of the congressional seats and a similar number of state legislative seats went to Republicans. That's how badly gerrymandered it has been. And the new plan, which is probably worse because the software has improved over the last decade, I would expect to be even more pronounced. So this is the kind of odds the Democrats are facing as we go into the 2022 midterms, because you're seeing, you know, one seat here, two seats there, and it's in the case of Texas, five seats there, going toward Republicans that were previously held by Democrats. And that's just based on the drawing of the map. That's not even considering, you know, the popularity of the Biden administration or policies or anything like that. So the Democrats really have a very, very uphill battle for the midterms in trying to retain a majority in the House of Representatives, just because of this phenomenon of gerrymandering, which in turn was legalized by the Supreme Court in a decision, I think, in about 2016, that they gave their stamp of approval to gerrymandering. So it's going full throttle now. And we're seeing this in red state after red state, where basically all of the Democratic voters in the state are being lumped into one or two districts, and the Republicans get everywhere else.
Yeah. And like you say, you know, it's just another mystery of the Democratic Party as to why they empower, you know, these situations. They continue.
Yeah, and why they didn't put more effort into trying to make gains in state legislative bodies over the last 10 years so this wouldn't happen, so that they would have more control of more state houses, but they don't.
Moving on to international and Israel launching a raid on the Al-Qaeda Mosque. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's one of the most sacred sites in Islam. It's in East Jerusalem, and Israeli forces on Friday raided it for, I'm not sure what the provocation was, but more than 150 Palestinians were injured that had been gathered to worship there. Now, it's the second week of Ramadan, so it's a particularly holy time of year also. So it's a very provocative act, and you're seeing demonstrations throughout the West Bank and Gaza, because quite understandably, Palestinians are angered by this. And, even though the eyes of the world are focused on Ukraine, keep half an eye peeled for what's going on in the Middle East, too, because that's likely also to blow up soon.
Well, yeah, what continues to happen and Palestine and Israel and the Middle East, and, you know, specifically targeting journalists, you know, during raids like that is all part of the mix as well.
Yes.
So journalists continue to be targeted more and more worldwide, but especially in conflict zones. So,
yeah, Mike, you were cutting out there.
Oh, okay. We're having technical difficulties this morning.
Yes. Please stand by.
All right. Well, that moves us on then to developments this week in Ukraine.
And it's been another grim week in Ukraine. Mariupol, according to its mayor, has been wiped off the map, is the phrase that he used. The mayor estimated that there are at least 22,000 dead civilians in the conflict there. And mind you, that's out of a population, the original population was about 400,000. And, you know, some number of those people had left before the city was besieged, and people have not been able to leave since then. The death toll there apparently has been very, very high. Of course, nobody can verify it because nobody can get in or out of the city. We saw a Russian, the flagship of their naval fleet in the fleet in the Black Sea was hit and sunk by a couple of missiles by Ukraine this week. That is a significant blow to efforts to take the city of Odessa, for example, because it really interferes with Russia's ability to do amphibious landings. So that was good news if you're rooting for Ukraine in this very grisly sporting event. Meanwhile, Russia has been doubling down on its offensive in the Middle East. It looks like most of its forces are reconcentrating there. It's still sending missiles into places like Kiev and Kharkiv, but the ground troops are gone. So basically all they're doing at this point is trying to kill civilians. And this lines up with, you know, what we're seeing increasingly in propaganda that's intended by Russia for its domestic audience, that is arguing explicitly that Ukraine, not only does Ukraine have no right to exist, but now Ukrainians have no right to exist because they're all Nazis, basically, is the argument. And they're basically calling for ethnic cleansing, for genocide. That Ukraine needs to be depopulated and repopulated by ethnic Russians. Needless to say, this is kind of alarming rhetoric, but it hasn't gotten a lot of attention in the West, unfortunately. If you remember in the first few weeks of the war, there were peace talks going on. Those have all broken down now. There's no longer peace talks. Ukraine keeps asking for ceasefires and protection for civilian combatants, and that's just not something that Russia seems interested in. So, it's going to get worse before it gets better, I'm afraid.
Meanwhile, what was once being called for no-fly zone from the West has been dropped.
Yeah, Ukraine would certainly like it, but NATO and countries like the U.S. have made it very clear that they don't want to go there. They don't want to risk nuclear war with Russia. Interestingly, Russia formally told the U.S. through its embassy in D.C., I believe it was Thursday, that it considers the U.S. arming Ukraine to be a provocation and that it is at war with the U.S. That, again, would lend itself to being concerned about nuclear war. And we had the head of the CIA this week saying that, yeah, they're actually quite concerned about that. So it's still a very, very dangerous situation, not just in Ukraine, but for the rest of the world also, in terms of we haven't been this close to a credible threat of nuclear annihilation in a long, long time. It's pretty much outside the experience of anybody who's under about the age of 50. Because, you know, when was the last time that happened? Well, probably the Bay of Pigs, or the Cuban Missile Crisis, and you know some of the rhetoric of Reagan in the early 80s. It's been that long since a lot of people worried about nuclear war, and of course here in Seattle we're pretty much ground zero. We're 20 miles downwind from one of the first targets that would be targeted in a nuclear exchange, given the large repository of nuclear weapons in the Bangor nuclear subbase in Kitsap County. So, not to mention all the other nuclear facilities and Amazon and all the rest of it. All we can do is keep an eye out. The Biden administration continues to send heavier levels of weaponry to Ukraine. That was not what was used in the sinking of that warship in the Black Sea. That was a Ukrainian-made missile that did that. That was a major victory for Ukraine. But, this is going to keep dragging on for a while, it looks like, unfortunately. And, you know, the Ukrainians who have not been able to get out are going to be the victims of it.
Well, and Washington also bears some responsibility for if a nuclear exchange or war did break out, for delivering, you know, a third of the missiles that the U.S. has onto other targets. I mean, we talk about being a target ourselves from that, but
sure.
People really need to reflect on the fact that they are, you know, cooperating along with a system that's just absolutely unthinkable.
Yeah, it really is. But unfortunately, right now, it's thinkable.
Yeah, I saw last night that apparently the U.S. had two B-52 bombers that had been over Europe overnight that were returning this morning. And even Canada was participating on their return coming across the ocean to the U.S. Canada. Sent out a bunch of fighters to do practice intercepting incoming Soviet nuclear bombers. So
I think you mean Russian. Oh, no, you mean Soviet. I'm sorry.
Well, no.
Same day.
Yeah, so anyway. All right, well, with that,
all right. With that, now that we're properly terrified people, we are out of time.
There you go. But hopefully we'll be back next week to further
keep you awake at night.
Scare off some of our listeners.
So, yeah. Okay.
Well, we will talk to you then.
Talk to you then.